Reuben Pedley lived in the city of New Umbra, a metropolis that was nonetheless as gloomy and run down as a city could be, though it had once enjoyed infinitely hopeful prospects. Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with writer Trenton Lee Stewart. The Secret Keepers, published by Little Brown Books for young readers, is a mystery involving time, directions, smoke, poetry, and riddles. Of all the city's depressed and depressing neighborhoods, the Lower Downs was considered the worst. Many of its old buildings were abandoned, others seemed permanently under repair. Its back streets and alleys were marked by missing shutters, tilted light poles, broken gates and railings, fences with gaps in them. The Lower Downs, in other words, was perfect for any boy who wanted to explore and to hide. Reuben Pedley, The Lower Downs, The Directions, The Smoke, The Mystery of Time, The Tale of Penelope, The Secret Keepers on Arts and Letters. From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today we'll be talking with Trenton Lee Stewart, author of the best-selling The Mysterious Benedict Society series. His newest book, The Secret Keepers, is about hiding in plain sight. Reuben made his habitual, rapid inventory of potential hiding places. A shady corner between a building's front steps and street-facing wall, a pile of broken furniture that someone had hauled to the curb, a window well with no protective railing. He preferred bona fide hiding places when he could find them, but there was nothing quite like hiding in plain sight. Trenton Lee Stewart, creator of Mysterious Societies, Puzzlers, and Mysterious Worlds, welcome.
Thanks very much. It's good to be here.
You write, Reuben likes to hide in plain sight. Why does Reuben want to hide?
He's already a shy kid, and then he's just discovered that he doesn't have in common with other boys and girls his age what he used to. So when they're younger, they would all like to play hide and seek, and he was really good at it. But then he doesn't change in the way that a lot of his peer group would change. And so he's left as a shy kid who had something he was really good at, which was hiding, and he makes it his own thing. That's something that he does to sort of fill empty spaces in his life, and he likes to pretend that it's important. Today, Reuben Pedley wanted to strike out into new territory, and there was no time to waste. 11 years had passed since the factory accident that left Reuben without a father and his mother, a young widow, scrambling for work. 11 years, in other words, since his own promising star had begun to fall.
So tell us about Reuben's childhood. He's not having a great time of it.
No, but he has kind of a couple of lives. His public life is non-existent. He's changed schools recently, and he and his mother are very poor. And so when he's at school, the book takes place during the summer, but we've just come off a school year in which he's changed schools. He doesn't really know people well. He doesn't have any friends. And so in that place, he's trying to essentially be invisible in his way. But at home, he has this very personal and excellent connection with his mom. So he is happy at home with his mother. They have a great time. She's funny and she's smart and they love each other. So he's got this excellent relationship at home, and that's a great thing. And then during the summer, he has come to value his ability to explore these back streets and spy on people.
And he lives in a place called Lower Down.
The neighborhood is the Lower Downs. It's the shambles of the city, which is already in a way a shambles itself. The Lower Downs was perfect for any boy who wanted to explore and to hide. Reuben was just such a boy. In fact, exploring and hiding were almost all he ever did.
Early on in The Secret Keepers, Reuben Pedley finds himself in a high place in Lower Downs. And this is epitomized by the picture, which is just phenomenal. And to describe it, it's called Walking Backward into the Sky. This is the first chapter. And you have Reuben walking backward, upside down, between two walls.
I wanted the book to start with him doing something that epitomizes who he is. So he's a solitary kid. He's in this solitary alley. But he's good at something, too. He's good at hiding, and he's good at climbing and exploring, and he's impulsive. So I think I meant for it to evoke a sense of the grandiosity of his private life, the feeling that he's doing important things even though he's just a solitary kid. But it's also supposed to evoke the visual effect as well. The brick walls of the abandoned buildings were so close to each other that Reuben saw at once how he might scale them. By leaning forward and pressing his palms against one, then lifting his feet behind him and pressing them against the other, he could hold himself, suspended above the alley floor. Then by moving one hand higher than the other, and then doing the same with his feet, he could work his way upward. It would be like walking backward into the sky. And high up on that ledge, Reuben comes across a leather pouch hidden in the wall, which contains a secret sign. You call it a secret thing. Yes. He's fascinated by the idea that this thing had to have been hidden there by someone like him, someone who'd seen how to get up to this out-of-the-way place that no one else would have thought to go. Feels like fate to him.
What does he pull out of the wallet?
An old leather pouch that contains within it a plastic bread sack, and then within that he finds this wooden case. So clearly somebody's gone to some trouble to try to really cover up this thing and protect it from the elements, and until he's revealed it, it doesn't look like it would necessarily be anything important. Then he reveals it and discovers that it's this really handsome wooden case. Inside the case were two velvet-lined compartments, both shaped to fit exactly the objects they contained. One of the objects was a small, delicate key with an ornate bow. The other appeared to be a simple metal sphere. The interior of one hemisphere was hollow, like an empty bowl. It served as the cover for the other hemisphere, which contained the face of a clock.
So Reuben evidently finds a clock watch.
Right. Though at this point he thinks of it as a pocket watch. He has no idea it's hundreds of years old, a kind of portable timepiece that actually dates back to an era when people weren't yet carrying such things around in their pockets. And yet, it was a pocket watch of a kind he'd never seen, to say nothing of its quality. Its face was made of a lustrous white material, perhaps ivory, and the hour hand and the Roman numerals around the dial gleamed black.
And there's no second hand.
He notices there's no second hand, and he thinks that it's a flaw. He thinks this otherwise perfect specimen of this beautiful antique watch has just at some point over time lost its second hand or its minute hand. And only later when he meets the watchmaker, who knows a good deal about the history of watches and clocks, does he discover that actually it was quite common in the very earliest days of these clock watches to only have an hour hand because they couldn't be precise. So an hour hand was as close as you needed to get.
This would be cool to find.
Right? Yeah. I mean, for sure.
For a kid.
Yeah.
Did you model this on a particular watch?
I looked at images of some very early watches from hundreds of years ago, and some of them were egg-shaped and some were barrel-shaped. I think I really felt some sort of strong connection with a sphere for some reason, maybe the ease of handling it, but also ultimately some of the secrets to the watch, I think they seem to work best when it formed a sphere. So I had read that some were spherical, and so I decided that this would be a perfect little glossy orb that he could keep in his pocket.
The inscription is property of P. W. M. Light. It's a curious inscription.
You know, I like to have my kids in my books figuring things out, and some of it goes on even behind the scenes and doesn't even appear on the page. So, for example, property of PWM Light, I think a lot of kids might read that and not recognize WM as an abbreviation for William. Even though I don't say so, I think Reuben probably doesn't know it either, but he fills in the gap. He thinks, oh, that must be William. So he imagines this person who owned this beautiful thing. But the inscription is actually on the case itself and not on the watch. And he's more drawn to the watch than he is to the inscription. So it's this mysterious figure from the past who at some point has possessed the watch. But he's so drawn to the watch itself that he pretty quickly dismisses the inscription as just focusing on the timepiece. He'd taken a terrible risk, but he'd come back with a treasure. It seemed like the end of an adventure. And yet somehow Reuben knew, he just knew, it was only the beginning.
We're talking with writer Trenton Lee Stewart about his otherworldly book, The Secret Keepers. Let's talk about the architecture of the book. Tell us about the world of New Umbra. And in this city, there are haves and have-nots. And it's an odd dystopic place. This isn't a pleasant world.
I chose that title to enhance that feeling. It's a shadowy place. So it used to be this thriving city, but now there's clearly something off about this old and rundown city.
What did you see happening to this town? Why did it become such an odd dictatorial oligarchy?
I had the notion that it was already, like many big cities, on the brink of decline, but the figure, the smoke, who ends up being the shadowy ruler of the city, came into power in some ways that are unknown to most people. He was able to essentially, through use of fear and intrigue, get a lot of people under his thumb.
He rules the city with directions, and they're like a compass. There's these four guys,
right, that's right.
And they all stand in opposite ways. So it's a panopticon. They're able to see everything, and they keep order by extorting business owners.
And they're funding the mysterious enterprises of their shadowy boss that nobody knows but everybody's afraid of, called the Smoke. So they funnel this money that they extort from local businesses, protection money, essentially an old school mafia scheme. They funnel it into the Smoke's pockets. But at the same time, everybody's afraid of them because they work for this entity that everybody is afraid of. And so nobody questions what they're doing, but nobody wants to challenge them. They keep order in the sense that everybody thinks that they just need to play by the rules, whatever these weird rules are. So it's a rundown city in which people are trying to do well, but operating in plain sight is a sort of like mafia-like organization where everybody's trying to make sure that they don't draw attention to themselves and do what they're asked by the directions when the directions show up in their businesses. And meanwhile, the directions are also roaming sets of eyes that are seeing everything everywhere in the city and reporting back anything unusual to the Smoke. A bell chimed as he entered. Then all was quiet, or what passed for quiet, in a room whose walls were lined with shelves of clocks and watches, most of them ticking, ticking, ticking.
Tell us about the clock store, because we don't have so many of those anymore.
Reuben discovers, after a morning that he's been going around to antique shops and jewelry stores to try to get a sense of the value of this watch. And the main thing that he's learned is that people seem to want it. And so that has made him really anxious over the course of this morning. People seem to covet this thing that he's brought in to show them. And so he's calling it a day and going home when he sees this sign, Clocks and Repairs. And it occurs to him, well, this is different from the places that I've been. This is somebody who thinks about watches and how they work. And so maybe this would be a good person to talk to, whoever runs the shop. And he goes and meets Mrs. Genevieve. Behind the counter, a door opened. An elderly woman in a light yellow summer cardigan appeared, holding a steaming teacup.
Yes?
Hello. May I set this down? I'd like to ask your opinion on something. It's an old pocket watch. My uncle asked me to find out what I could about it, how old it is, what it might be worth, that sort of thing. Lifting a hand to hold her glasses in place, she bent to peer more closely at the case and its contents. She made no move to touch them, though, and presently she straightened and indicated with a subtle gesture that Reuben could put the things away.
Not now. First, I must meet briefly with foreman. You know who I mean, the foreman who go about, looking always to different corners.
Oh, yes, the directions.
Yes, I must meet with these directions. They'll be here in 2 minutes or no longer than three. It's the only thing that I respect about these men. That in this way, they are like clockwork.
Hiding in plain sight is an asset, but becomes an imperative. He realizes that people are looking for this object.
Well, that's what he ultimately finds out from Mrs. Genevieve. He gets the sense of it before he meets her that people want it, but he thinks it's just because it's this beautiful thing, and people maybe want to swindle him out of it and then make money on it themselves. But then once he's spoken with Mrs. Genevieve, he discovers that it's much bigger than that, much more dangerous than he'd realized.
And Mrs. Genevieve, really the counterpoint to his mother, how did you imagine her?
One of the things that I decided that I would let stay was a certain degree of mysteriousness about her origins and her background. Reuben knows some things about her, but he never knows everything about her. And one of the reasons for that is that thematically, the whole book is about what people can know and what they can't know, and most particularly about people. that people are in themselves probably the greatest mystery.
And she's wary of Reuben.
Yeah, he shows up with this thing that she recognizes instantly as trouble. That's right. But he doesn't know it yet. And yet she has an instinctive appreciation of the magnificence of this timepiece. And even though she doesn't show it at first, a softness for a kid. He's a kid. He's vulnerable. And so all of these things come into play eventually. Reuben chose to wait in the rooms behind the door. He heard the chime of the doorbell. And without hesitation, he jumped up from the sofa and put his ear to the shop door.
Good afternoon.
Same to you.
What's the news?
No news, unless one of you wishes to purchase something. That would be news indeed.
You made that joke before.
It still isn't funny.
He imagined four large men nosing about the shop.
So, do you have our...
Reuben heard two brisk, business-like taps. He pictured the man receiving an envelope full of money, tapping it a couple of times on the counter, and sliding it into a pocket.
Just a glance at your books. Very good. Anything unusual to report, Mrs. Genevieve?
You talked about them functioning like the mafia collecting money on being on the lookout. And they're menacing.
They have this power. They are a group of four men moving around. To a kid, that's a menacing scenario if you have to encounter four men who seem gruff and, you know, trying to take care of some business. But they also carry with them this invisible power, the sense that they work for somebody who has a reputation of being the most terrifying figure in the city, even though nobody really knows what this person looks like or if he's real or what he is. I mean, they know he's something, but nobody knows what, and nobody wants to ask questions because that's very much frowned upon.
He's the smoke.
That's the smoke.
Right. That's all we ever get from you.
I need to use your bathroom.
It is out of order.
And you never have any need of a bathroom yourself?
Reuben snatched up his backpack and cast about the sitting room for a good place to hide. Then Reuben had an idea and hurried into the bathroom. Moving fast, he removed the porcelain top from the toilet tank and lowered it noiselessly onto the bathroom rug. He reached inside the tank and jerked loose the flush chain just as he heard the shop door open. Reuben stepped into the bathtub, retreating behind the bath curtain. The man's heavy footsteps came from the sitting room.
Well, what do you know?
The man doesn't believe, Mrs. Genevieve, that no one's there.
Well, he doesn't really believe that the bathroom's broken. Maybe he
right,
just
because she's
bathroom. Trying to keep him from going in there by creating this fabrication. And Reuben has gotten a sense of what's going on. He can't hear very well, but he can tell that something's happening where the guy's going to come back and see if she's telling him the truth. And so his first thought is to protect himself. And then his second thought is to help Mrs. Genevieve out in the same time.
And this is where Mrs. Genevieve begins to trust him, because he's quick thinking, he's clever, and his speedy actions extricate him from impending trouble.
A moment later, the shop door closed.
You thought to save me by breaking the chain. That was a quick idea.
He was rude.
He was the worst of them. But how is it he did not see you?
I hid behind the bathroom curtain.
Very risky.
I'm a good hider.
But this was a risky act nonetheless, and I thank you for it. Now let us examine this pocket watch of yours. Set it over there. You may stand nearby, but you must keep your shadow away, okay?
Tell us what Miss Genevieve knows and finds out about the watch.
What she knows right off the bat upon seeing it, and which she eventually reveals to Reuben, much to his dismay, is that for a very, very long time, someone has been seeking this watch. And then she clarifies that by saying, well, it's the smoke who has been looking for this watch. And she knows that because periodically people at establishments like hers get approached by the directions and ask her, have you seen this specific thing? So she knows that, but she doesn't reveal it right away because she can't help herself. Before she scares him or frightens him away, she wants to examine it because it's this gorgeous thing, and it's her life is devoted to clocks and watches. She studied the case a moment, then opened it.
It is beautiful. I do not know this metal, though I know metals very well. It seems impossible, the condition of this piece. How can it be so perfect?
The minute hand broke off, I guess, so it may not be perfect, but still.
Oh, it never had a minute hand. The pocket watches of this time told only the hour. In the early days of clocks, there was no use for a minute hand. Such precision was impossible at the time. Even with the hour hand, there was much inaccuracy.
The early days. When are we talking about exactly?
There is no exactly, but I would tell you that this pocket watch was made in the late 15th or early 16th century. Such watches of this time, they were called clock watches, for they were not always kept in pockets. They were fine decoration to be worn by wealthy persons about the neck or hung from a chain, though sometimes, yes, they were carried in pockets.
Mrs. Genevieve returned then to her examination of the watch, and Reuben excitedly pondered the significance of her words. The fact that she was so struck by the piece's beauty and rarity suggested that he might truly be in possession of an extraordinarily valuable artifact, perhaps even a priceless one.
Very well. I know some things, and some things I do not know, and both for the same reason.
Another great line. Would you say that kind of sums up the book?
Well, I definitely think it gets at some of the stuff that I was trying to play around with in the book and highlight in the book, the things that we know and we don't know, and in particular, the essential unknowability of people, including ourselves.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to Trent Lee Stewart as he talks about the hidden movements in his book, The Secret Keepers.
Reuben hurried into his bedroom and opened his backpack. He was going to figure this out. A watch that had to be wound every 15 minutes was ridiculously impractical. So of course, Mrs. Genevieve was right. The spring must have been designed for some other purpose, a secret purpose. Mrs. Genevieve had seen no way to open the watch from the outside, but what if something made it open up from the inside? He turned his head toward the wooden box sitting open on his bed. He gazed at the inscription on its lid. Hey, Mr. Light, what's the secret?
You're very well able to carry a kind of mystery and elongate it.
Yeah, and I hope that that's a rewarding experience for the reader and not a maddening one. But I love that kind of thing. I always loved secrets within secrets as a kid. And so I try to plot it out, sometimes maybe over elaborately, but in ways in which there's always something around the next corner. There's something within behind the last door.
Right. And at one point, in order to pursue the riddle of the clock watch, Reuben finds himself following the light.
It's riddle-like in itself. It's clue-like in itself because it can be thematic. What is the light? What is the dark? In a book that's about transparency versus opacity. But then at the same time, very specifically, once he realizes the word is not exactly what he thought it was, it becomes a kind of clue.
Here he's in the library.
P. William Light? Who is he?
That's what I'm trying to find out. I think he might have been someone important, probably around 100 years ago. Now the librarian was looking down at his desk. His eyebrows were so bushy, they overwhelmed the rims of his glasses. It made his glasses appear to have eyelashes.
Indexed?
Half an hour later, the desk was covered with binders, directories, and other assorted volumes. The librarian had gone through them one by one as Reuben stood anxiously watching, shifting his weight from foot to foot. The librarian drew his finger down rows and rows of words, page after page.
You're looking for a person, not a place? Because there is a place, Point William, a town about 50 miles up the coast, and the lighthouse there is called the Point William Light.
Reuben blinked. P. William Light. Point William Light. And now Reuben knew that he had to go to Point William. He would find the answers there. He'd known it the instant he learned the truth about the inscription. A voice in his head, his own voice, but somehow smarter and more confident than him, had said it plainly. Follow the light.
You are wonderful at bringing us to places that are mysterious for kids. Clock stores, libraries, and now lighthouses.
There's a lot to do with light and darkness in this book, secrets and revelations. So bringing in a family of lighthouse keepers, once that occurred to me, it seemed too perfect to resist. So this family's been literally keeping the light for generations, but they've also been keeping a secret.
So Reuben fabricates an elaborate deception to his mother about visiting a friend for a sleepover. He boards a train. He expertly avoids the directions and an odd staring stranger. And he finds himself, after having trudged through the muck and fought through swarms of gnats, on Point William Island, hiding behind an oil drum, watching.
The girl slipped out into the sunlight. As she drew close enough for Reuben to get a good look at her, he saw she was not wearing a bright red hat after all, but rather a startling, wiry mass of red hair that shot up from her scalp like a volcanic eruption. The girl began to recite a sort of chant.
Scarcely seen at low tide, never seen at high. Only from the watery side, never from the dry. Always bring your tools, mate, and keep your lanterns low. The rights are all for fools, mate, the lefts for those who know. So go ye at the low tide, and never at the high. Above the X, below the I, get in and out or die. Above the X, below the Y, get in and out or die.
It was a curious sort of poem, to be sure. It sounded like a pirate riddle. That part about X made him think of a treasure map.
Above the X, below the Y, get in and out or die.
Above the X, below the Y, get in and out or die.
And then the mystery unfolds with the mysterious tale of Penelope. Would you read just a little bit from that? It's a story within a story.
Every generation of Myers had proved well-suited to the sacred duty of keeping the light. They had, without exception, been constant, reliable, unfailing in their duties. So highly regarded was the Meyer family as an institution of solid, honest folk, sound of judgment and steady of course, that when one day there came along a Meyer who was unpredictable, unconventional, reckless, and daring, no one in Point William, or indeed anywhere, knew what to make of her. Was it not inevitable? All those children, all those years, all those ships. Why should it have been surprising that at least one child would grow up yearning to see the world? Such a one was Penelope Meyer. To put it plainly, as she herself would have done, Penelope was an adventuress. By the age of 12, she was teaching her beloved younger brother, Jack, all manner of surprising things, such as how to steal honey from beehives and pies from windowsills, how to build campfires in the rain, how to tie knots so complicated that no one could untie them but her. At 13, she built her own raft. When it proved unseaworthy and sank a mile offshore, she swam back, wrung out her clothes, and announced her plan to build a better one. Bold enough to take chances, smart enough to learn from her failures, Penelope Meyer grew into a young woman who wore trousers instead of skirts, rode horses and sailed boats, both of which, as often as not, were borrowed without their owner's precise knowledge, and seemed every bit as likely to punch a man as to curtsy to him. Her parents loved her, but could do nothing with her. Her brother could never keep her in check, though she let him bind her wounds and listen to her tales. And when at age 17 she stowed away on a ship bound for Gibraltar, Jack found her note 2 days later. No one in Point William was surprised.
And I'm just interested in why you made that move at that point in the book, because we kept the narration going with Reuben.
Right.
And then you make a deliberate decision.
Based upon the way that we expect books like this for kids to go, it seems counterintuitive that you would slow down the momentum. But you talked about the architecture of the book earlier. So it's in three discrete parts. So I sort of envision it as three hills. At the end of the first section, you've sort of crested one hill, you've reached a kind of climax, but then you're down at the bottom of another hill that's slightly taller, and you have to work your way back up, but it's rewarding. The top of the second hill, the second section, you have a view. You can see everything that's come before. And then the hope for me was that the final effect at the end of the third section is you really have mounted this greatest climax. You can look back over all the road that you've traveled, and it feels like the completion of a really long and complex journey.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to composers Travis Bowman, The Damsels in Distress, Amy Jo Savannah, and the amazing Silas Haidt, who kept us in time and enthralled with their musical secrets. Thank you to actors Lucy Lukotkova, Simon Hawkins, Paz Tiedemann, Daniel Breen, Josh Enlow, Michael Hiblin, and Nathan Vandiver for lending us your voices. Thank you to Mr. Chris Hickey, who recorded the show. Thank you to intern Krista Hancock. A very special thank you to Mary Ellen Cuban for the timely advice. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writer Trenton Lee Stewart, whose mysterious fictional worlds allow us to sit still as the minute hand makes its circular journey through and beyond our imaginations. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Dave Eggers. Books have a unique way of stopping time in a particular moment and saying, let's not forget this.